segment. So I'm going to talk about one of the popular knowns that takes place in the context of the Palomar Quest Survey. Tomorrow, George will talk about a lot of the other things that that survey is capable of finding. So the nearby supernova factory, as the name implies, is meant to find a lot of nearby supernovae. We want to find them early, follow them spectroscopically, with the goal of making them better calibrated tools for cosmology. And this collaboration consists of a couple of different U.S. Universities, UC Berkeley, University of Chicago, and Yale. And then we have three institutions in France, in Lyon and Paris, both people from astronomy and from high energy physics. And we have partnered with a number of different groups. So the three groups here, the Quest Collaboration, Caltech Palomar Observatory, and the Near Earth Asteroid Tracking are what consists of the Palomar Consortium that run the Palomar Quest Survey. And then there's internet connectivity through HPRN and the Energy Sciences Network. Our follow-up is done at University of Hawaii principally. And then there's also funding and computing that are very important components of this. So we really have two goals. First, a statistical goal. Really many more nearby type 1a supernova are needed. When you do cosmology, you're comparing low and high redshift supernova. So it doesn't help to just get lots and lots more high redshift supernova. In fact, with most of the programs now ongoing, Supernova Legacy Survey in essence, this is a limiting factor, and we expect it will be a limiting factor for future supernova work. So you want to really beef up the sample just from a statistical standpoint. And in doing that, you really have to improve the systematics. Even simple things like calibration at the fraction of percent level become important. But then there are also really a number of questions about the subtle behavior of type 1a supernova. And indeed, whether low redshift and high redshift supernova could be somehow different, or that when we get these larger samples, there will be very subtle biases. So our goal is to get 300 nearby type 1a supernova. We want to work out in the smooth Hubble flow, so we're not dominated by peculiar velocities, because in looking at the systematics, we want to correlate other properties of supernova, light curve width, kinematics, things like this, with the luminosity. So we need accurate relative distances to do this, and so we have to be in the smooth Hubble flow. This also, it turns out, is an important issue for just averaging properly over the bulk flows in the local universe. And we want to do this with spectrophotometry. So we're not taking light curves per se. We take spectra, gives a lot of spectral information. We can synthesize photometry in any optical band. So again, just so cosmologists always like to show parameter contours. So here are sort of the one sigma constraints on this equation of state of the dark energy, and this is what we might expect after the supernova legacy survey runs, and adding the nearby sample significantly reduces then the uncertainty on the constant equation of state. And in the future, assuming we're going beyond something like a cosmological constant, then we actually want to look at the time domain. So there's a constant term and then some term that evolves with redshift. So these would be contours, for instance, from the supernova acceleration probe, and then how you get an improvement with the nearby supernova. And just probably this audience doesn't need too much refresher, so I'll go through this quickly. Basically, we standardize the type 1As by using a relationship between the width of their light curves and their brightnesses. So fast light curves, fastly declining are the fainter ones. The ones that take longer to rise and fall are the brighter ones, and you can homogenize these to a little worse than 10% in brightness, so like 5 to 7% in distance. There's a lot of physical information available in the spectra of supernova. So basically you're seeing, as you look at it deeper and deeper into the atmosphere, and actually you're seeing different depths in different lines depending on the optical depth in various iron group elements. And you can watch this evolve as you pass through the different layers of the supernova where there's been a different amount of burning. And so really having the spectroscopy time series gives you a lot more information for understanding the physics of the type 1a supernova. And there are just even some empirical features, so the silicon line which you'd like to see there are luminosity indicators that are independent of the light curve. For instance, the ratio between these two features here, these two calcium features here. There are also issues when you go to high redshift, people always say, well, metallicity is going to be an issue, and you really need to look in the UV spectra of the supernova to get a handle on that, or you can also look a bit in the infrared. So basically what we're trying to do is look at the parameter space of the type 1a supernova, and the only part we care about for cosmology is the luminosity part, and we want to know how these other properties correlate with luminosity, if they do. Cosmologists would be really happy, basically, if, you know, stretch or one of these other indicators like the silicon line ratio gives you the luminosity, and that you don't have to worry about a lot of second order effects. But that remains to be seen. We certainly know that they're not there in the overwhelming sense, but they could be there in a subtle sense. So you'd think that this would have all been done. All the work has got to be for the high redshift supernova searches. Those are all the faint supernova. Those are the hard ones to find, right? Well, there's a big difference in finding near and nearby supernova. If you look at high redshift, you can look in about 20 typical 4-meter pointings and get 20 supernova. Right? So you're processing a pretty modest amount of data. If you want to do a blind search nearby, so you don't want to be biased, you want to search the same way that you're searching at high redshift, as the previous speaker just discussed, you really have to look at many, many more fields just to get a single supernova. So this is just a comparison of the data volume. For supernova fact, you have to process about 50 gigabytes every night. Take something like Supernova Legacy Survey, something like 5 gigabytes every third night. So the amount of data you have to sift through is really much, much larger to find a nearby supernova, unless you do what Kate does, which is focus on known galaxies, which also have to be high luminosity galaxies to get some sort of efficiency. I just want to touch a little bit on the Palomar Quest survey so people have some background, but George is going to discuss this a lot more tomorrow. It's really centered around the Quest 2 camera, which is on the Ocean Schmidt at Palomar, the 1.2 meter. This camera's quite impressive, 112 CCDs. This is actually before the CCDs are in, but you can see there are four fingers, and 112 CCDs are spread amongst those. Each of them is so long and narrow to allow a drift scan mode. And so the camera in its entirety covers about 9.4 square degrees. It's got a 40-second readout time, or can be operated so that it clocks at the sidereal rate. Here's a nice picture of the Andromeda Galaxy taken with this camera. And the survey is done in two modes. There's a point-and-track mode, motivated mostly by efforts to discover asteroids and Kuiper Belt objects. It takes three exposures over 30 minutes, either these shorter exposures for asteroids or longer for Kuiper Belt in a long pass red filter. And then there's the drift scan done in either Johnson or Gunn filters. This is just some idea of the nightly sky coverage. So this is unique area. Just take a night, find all the unique area. Of course, it's heavily modulated by time of year, and all the zeros down here are bad weather or computer failures. But you get some idea here of it. We're sort of running typically about 600 square degrees a night on the nights that we're able to operate. And of interest to people here will be the time sampling. So if you go back, this data set actually spans back to 2003, and then there was a camera before that, so that's about 6 years worth of data. And here are the very short intervals, basically, for the asteroid searching. Then there's a spike sometimes when you happen across a piece of sky the next night, just to a point overlap. But it stretches back here several years. So this is basically a data set that's right for looking for all kinds of transients. And George will discuss that some more tomorrow. But we're really focusing on the type 1a supernova in this data set. So we have a couple of other constraints. Sorry, this just didn't turn out great, but right ascension and declination. There's an area in the sky here, basically, where we are able to do follow-up with the telescope at Hawaii. We have the second half of the night, as I'll explain later. So this cuts out some part of the sky. This is a region that is excluded by the moon. Don't want to be too close to the moon. These are the areas on the sky where the asteroids, main belt asteroids, are in retrograde. If you search there, you're going to get swamped with asteroids. Sometimes we search there. And the MPEC checker, as people have said, allow you to eliminate brighter asteroids. But these data go down to 21st magnitude pretty easily. And so there are many asteroids that won't be found. They'll be very slow moving. So there's the venerable Ocean Schmidt at Palomar. So there was a prototype search before the Quest camera came on. This was Michael Lugosi's thesis on 99 supernova. That's first year for a supernova program. Then we adapted that pipeline used on the Quest 2 camera. And these numbers are a little old, I think a couple months old, but we had 71 spectroscopically confirmed supernova and 89 probable supernova. This is just sort of how things have ramped up. So it took a while to get everything adapted, but here's the increase in the number of supernova. Here are the confirmed 1As. It's rolled over in the last couple months, partly because in Hawaii our instrument was damaged, so we were down for a month for follow-up and didn't search quite as much. Then there was a lightning strike in Hawaii that took us down for another week, and then the weather's bad at Palomar. So we'll see once things pick back up with better weather and our instrument's back online now, the numbers should keep going up. And as the previous speaker mentioned, when you do these blind searches, you do unearth some strange objects. So this was one of the supernova found by Michael Woodbasey in his search, 2002 IC, first example of a type 1A with hydrogen circumstellar material. And in Michael's paper here, we basically modeled this in the thin shell approximation as superposition of a supernova and then it plowing into some circumstellar material. We found more of these types of objects. The other thing is that in the same year this was found, O2CX, the so-called failed type 1A, was found again in blind search. We find a lot of faint things, and for the supernova work we have to be a little careful on what we invest spectroscopy time in looking at, because the bulk of our objects will be high redshift supernova at maximum light, and we want early supernova. So this is just a simulation for type 1A supernova, assuming that we take all candidates above 20.5 in R. If we just had a spectroscopic cut and only then looked at the ones for the 19th, we'd get these green objects here, but we'd miss a few others. And so what we try to do in one way or another is to look in this diagram. Basically the rate of rise is the thing rising quickly is the earliest, easiest way and not an extremely biased way to tell whether you have a type 1A supernova. We don't implement this religiously. If something looks basically like it's on a galaxy, we tend to go get spectroscopic follow-up of it. But basically we want to eliminate this pool of higher redshift supernova at max. So the way we get some of this is sometimes the Palomar Quest survey will have looked at a piece of sky one or two nights later and we see the thing hasn't changed in brightness. Or we screen it at 1 meter class telescopes at McDonald or Lick. Or we may screen it photometrically at the University of Hawaii 2.2 meter, where we also do our spectroscopic screening. So let me tell you a little bit about the spectroscopic screening, because I think it's of general interest to this audience. It's an integral field unit spectrograph with a 6x6 arc second of field. So basically we identify where we are on the sky, we move the target into the 6x6 region, we get a spectrum of each of these, what we call spaxels. And this is just a schematic here. Actually, we have a 15x15 micro lens array. So we get a spectrum of each location on the sky, giving us a data cube from which we can pull out the supernova. This is also generally of interest if you have targets that aren't extremely well localized. You don't know exactly where they are. You can just pop them down this integral field unit. With the data cube, we get spectra at each epoch, so eventually we get a spectral time series, or we can use synthetic photometry and get a light curve. And I won't go into the optical layout, but I'll just show you. Here's the instrument on the side of the University of Hawaii 2.2 meter.
Five minutes.
Yeah. Okay. So as I said, we got 20% time on the 2.2 meter. We get second half of the night. This is parceled in two half nights every five nights. The instrument's always there, which makes it very stable. We operate it remotely with supervised observing, so our French collaborators take the night shifts, it's daytime for them, and we take the day shifts where the calibration and setup is done. As I said, automated acquisition of the field identification, positioning, guide star selection, etc. Makes it pretty easy to get on to the targets, and I won't go through this. No. So here's an example. This is not exactly typical, this is one of our better examples. Spectral time series of supernova publicly discovered. And so you can just see the evolution in the various features of the Type 1a supernova. And our spectral data set so far is equal to about 60% of all the supernova spectra that have been published since 1937.
But there's a lot of unpublished spectral data, right?
Yep.
Now there's more.
So, and there's also HST follow-up, which was in fact done part with Alex Stolpenko and many, probably everyone in the supernova community to get UV spectral time series on some of these supernova. So here's the redshift distribution as it stood in November of 2005. 42 type 1As, 21 type 2s, 2 BCs, many untyped. So these are all the type 1As. And these are the ones that we're really focusing on. Get too close, peculiar velocities hurt us. Get too far, and the spectra are not all that great. And sometimes we expand that range a little bit. So something like 1,000 spectra at about 600 epochs have been taken. As I said, 160 supernova. We have good spectral time series for about 30 type 1As. More supernova that show hydrogen. These examples of the O2CX type supernova. Some UV optical follow-up. And a number of interesting supernova in terms of understanding the behavior of these objects. So here's just an example of the kind of analysis we do with a fairly simple code developed by the Texas group to try to identify the lines and get their velocity structure, so you can get some idea of where the different elements arise in the ejecta of the supernova, because you can map velocity onto radius. And we just have now a code that will do this automatically. It used to take a trained postdoc a couple of weeks to do this fitting. We have a parallelized version that will now do it in a few minutes to give us the basic structure of the supernova. Type of things we want to look at are things like this velocity evolution. There's some indication that these may break up into different classes of objects based on the kinetic energy of the explosion measured from the silicon line. So I promised to say a few things about other types of things that we find by accident. So except for everything in this little diagram, the other things here are contaminants to us. There's asteroids, there's all these other types of eruptive stars. And I used to know a lot more about these when I was a young lad in the AAVSO, but have forgotten a lot of that. Here's an example of a star that actually was the inverse. It disappeared at one epoch. So you can go to Sloan, you see it. You see it in many of our other images. At one epoch, it disappeared. That's an example of something I don't know what that is. It was far too deep, I think, to be an eclipse. Here are some other types of objects. So things with Balmer series emission, a couple of helium lines, which I think are probably CVs, but I'm not an expert on that. Some sort of bright blue star with Balmer absorption. Again, not an expert on that. If anyone sees something that they like in there, let me know. And this one object, which I think the only thing we haven't been able to figure out what it was. At first we thought it was an early supernova, but it stayed constant for 2 weeks. So let me just summarize here. The nearby supernova factory focuses on use of type 1a supernova for cosmology. A key component of that is the Palomar Quest survey. We have the SNFS supernova integral field spectrograph for the screening classification. We also use that then for the follow-up spectrophotometric time series. The things that we find so far, I think, are known contaminants, asteroids, variable stars, and AGN. If we classified our CVs correctly, 6 CVs, about 7 AGN, this object that disappeared, and we don't know what it is. One star that we haven't been able to classify, and one thing that we haven't been able to classify as even whether it's in our galaxy or not. And one thing I want to emphasize so that your questions are appropriately directed is these other transients, the non-1As, are basically the purview of other people in the Palomar Quest consortium. So they get passed on. For instance, Avishai Galyam and Shri are interested in core collapse supernova, etc.
Thanks.
So let me take the prerogative. So for the 1As, since you're doing a blind survey, you can start to say something about what types of galaxies these are preferentially occurring in at those redshifts. So I assume for all these, you know, you have a galaxy type, you know what type of galaxies, terms of morphology and even probably, well, colors and probably even morphology. Can you say anything about what you're finding there in terms of the...
Well, so we've just started looking at this, in fact. I think we may have a bias, actually, against finding supernova in nice bright galaxies for various reasons due to the limited dynamic range of the CCD. Some of those actually saturate and get flagged out by our software. In terms of things on little galaxies, we find lots of those, but I don't know if it's in excess of the number expected.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the disappearing star? What magnitude? Did you look at Sloan colors? Did you look at
so that you can see in this false color image that Sloan had, it's a fairly blue star, probably the color of a B star or something like that. And in Sloan, it was about 19 and a half. And we, in the image where it disappeared, that went down to 21st magnitude.
Well, do you know it's not the quasar?
Yeah. Well, so the only thing that I really know about it is that it was seen at roughly the same magnitude at four or five other epochs, spaced over something like 3 years, and it's disappeared. So really, I know nothing more than that. For me, I don't care, right? It's not a 1A, clearly, so I don't care. But
I'll tell you what it is. It's formed carbon and it's disappeared because you're looking at the wrong band.
Yeah.
It'll be a bright, I'm willing to bet, $10, then I'll take it.
I figured someone here would know what it is.
Are its coordinates public?
I can certainly give them to you.
No, you will give them to me.
Well. Yes. George's response is the right one, yes. He gets all the weird things.
Yeah, so that's a question. On what time scale do these strange things that your garbage that could be someone else's garden, how do those get publicized to the universe?
Well, so basically what happens is a breakdown on who is supposed to find different kinds of things in the Palomar Quest survey. So we're after the 1As, so when we find things that look like supernova, we try to screen them. We give them to Avishai Galyam, who's mostly at this point interested in the ones that we have screened, so he knows they're type 1As or, in Sri's case, 1BCs. The biggest issue really is asteroids. I mean, if I put everything out there, there'd be a lot of people going after asteroids.
But is there a way to feed back into the minor planet world? And you're pushing the minor planets down to 21, 22, and we know that they're complete to 18 or something. Is there a way to feed that into that system so that when you go back to that field or a similar field, you're not refining things you already know in garbage?
Well, that's obviously a good idea. I think this is, George, what you're planning to do.
Which he knows very well.
Yes. I mean, the difference here is that we're running the image subtraction pipeline. So we do find asteroids, but image subtraction is not a technique that is any better than catalog searching for finding asteroids. So other people are doing the catalog searching.
Ashish should comment on this.
It's essentially the same data that we are using. So the list of asteroids that we'll put out will be the same.
Okay. Yeah.
We will
okay.
be feeding it to the minor planet center. And we'll event that.
Yeah, I mean, the world will change with Pan-SAR not the sole issue. A major part of Pan-SAR is to deal with the asteroid part. And we have an entire system, the moving object pipeline, that's been described in the literature and talked about. And you know, we will incorporate all the Pan-SAR discovery, which will vastly overwhelm everything in the minor planet center. And maintain a database and do all the orbital linkages and put these things out. And it'll be down to the magnitude of the 24s. So the whole asteroid thing will change dramatically once we're online and moving the object pipeline system is online. And that system is funded and we'll proceed and start producing results within a year.
So in your research highlight, you said you found 106 supernova in 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you publish all the supernova? I didn't really recall that kind of frequency from scroll effect.
Well, so a lot of them are out in the ATALs. If they're the type 1As that we're following, then they don't always go out because we're working on them. So, but I think you can go and look. I mean, there are ATELs that probably have 50 or 60 of our supernova. There was a period of time when we didn't quite know what to do with them because we tried the IE circular route and Dan Green couldn't or wouldn't, you know, put them out, so then we did the ATEL.
So is there any particular motivation to not giving away these positions from the supernovae?
Sorry?
I mean, ideally, you know, you want to publish the positions for the supernovae, so other people can do follow-up on if they want to. That's what we are doing now, right? You know, so I'm just wondering whether, why the position...
Well, so I think most of them do go out, yeah. I mean, it does take time, right, to prepare these things in the historical format that people have wanted them in. You know, so-and-so observed something with such-and-such a telescope over this spectral range and this resolution. Right, it takes effort. So if someone wants to give you a postdoc to handle that, that'd be fine.
Another question is, your goal is 300 supernovae,
yeah.
Multiple epoch of spectral photometry.
Yeah.
And how many you have already observed right now?
So we've got about 30 with good spectral time series right now. So we're running, you know, slower than expected for that.
Is there any sample light curves for that?
Sorry, anyone?
Sample light curves. Like,
no, not yet. No, no.
Yeah, so for this Houdini star, my bet is it's our Corona Borealis. Yeah.
That's sort of what I was guessing, sure. But like I said, I knew someone here would know. So we can have that as a wager.
How much do you bet?
Go check it.
Oh, I would bet.
I'll bet it's crazy.
Now we're getting somewhere.
So I have a question. This histogram you showed
about
the supernovae in November, I think.
Yeah.
You have 41 age, and these are the numbers I remember, 60 without spectrum.
Yeah.
Now, what selection criteria went into, or were there any selection criteria involved in those events, and you have the spectrum
and others came out? So partly it's how much spectroscopic follow-up time we have. The other criterion is this one I mentioned. If we are able to show that it's not brightening, then we don't go after it spectroscopically.
That's so repeat that again. What is the criteria?
If we can demonstrate that it is not getting brighter, say over a period of 2 days, then we do not follow it spectroscopically because it cannot be an early type 1A supernova. And our biggest contaminant for in the survey, aside from asteroids, which just wouldn't be there, are the high redshift supernova at max. So redshift 0.2 supernova at maximum light.
So any more subluminous 1As? I couldn't quite tell you how to...
Yeah, so this is all sort of work in progress as to whether, you know, what the luminosities are and things like that. We have a pipeline that needs a few tweaks for reducing the integral field spectrograph data before we actually know what the luminosities of everything is.
But are you going to have it's sort of also what Wade talked about, but I just still remember these two different papers, one by Andy Howell, one by Brad Schaefer, on the potential for a large number of subluminous 1As in terms of what searches have been done in the past. These are sort of five-year-old papers.
Yeah, so there...
You're going to get insights as to these blind searches, how that's turning out.
So interestingly, the kind of search that Kate is doing is much better for determining the luminosity function. Our problem is we see something, we may or may not see a galaxy associated with it. Even if we see a galaxy associated with it, the odds that it has a redshift are pretty low, right? So you have to go to a lot of work for a lot of things that you're not following in order to answer a question like that. Whereas for Kate, they know the redshift, right? And so they know what luminosity they're probing to much more accurately. So I think it's actually a cleaner way to get the luminosity function at the very thin end.
Okay, any further questions? Okay, so we're going to break now.